You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
This is a Ravel Podcast Network show.
Ravel.ca.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, a show produced by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire was produced at CILU-FM on Fort William First Nations Anishinaabe Territory, part of Robinson Superior Treaty in Thunder Bay, Ontario. I'm JL Chung.
And I'm Carly Forbes.
10 tons of mercury was put in our river system and it's still in there.
Should neglect them, especially when it comes with life and death. And it could have been prevented if they did the right thing by calling 911 right away.
In this edition, speakers from the annual River Run in support of clean water for Grassy Narrows First Nation, and an in-depth look into the negligence leading to the deaths of prisoners Errol Green and Holly Hall. But first, here's the headlines.
On May 17th, the federal government introduced legislation guaranteeing human and legal rights to transgender people. Meanwhile, transgender people have been speaking out about the relative silence around the recent arson to the only clinic providing gender-affirming surgeries in Canada. CKUT's Lindsay Dixon brings us this headline.
A medical clinic in Montreal was damaged on the evening of May 2, 2016. The CMC is a private medical center and the only medical clinic in Canada that offers gender-affirming surgeries to trans peoples. There was $700,000 worth of damage. The media has been relatively quiet about the hate crime, and trans individuals have been wondering why the media has been so silent about such a heinous act of violence. I spoke with Sophia Banks, who, on Twitter, describes herself as a trans woman, queer, artist, writer, photographer, and advocate. I asked her, why are the media and police not more concerned for safety of trans peoples within this, refusing to name the arson as an act of anti-trans violence?
The cops have mentioned that they kind of might be investigating it as a hate crime. It really hasn't been clear in the media what exactly is going on with that. But essentially, I think it's alarming that a clinic that does specialize in, you know, gender reassignment surgery for trans people would be targeted by an armed arsonist.
Yeah.
Especially considering that's the only clinic in Canada. And certainly, after a while, there was some media attention, but it felt like, you know, I had to yell on Twitter, and essentially I feel like the only reason it really got any media attention is because I know all the journalists who wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm friendly with them, and we talk on Twitter, so, like, if I hadn't been connected to the media that way, would this have gotten any press at all? Funny enough, today I was just reading that Canada's finally announced that they will be adding federal protections to trans people. Hopefully this year. Alarm, not surprising that it comes, you know, 2 weeks after if someone tried to burn down the only clinic in Canada. As it stands in Canada, it's not illegal to discriminate against trans people. Attacking someone for being trans would not be seen as a hate crime. Not that I necessarily think that is the right way to go with the prison system, but I do think it's important that we do keep these stats. But as it stands right now, we don't have any stats in Canada about how many people are being attacked for being trans or discrimination against trans people. We have very small surveys done for, like, say, a few LGBT orgs, but we have no actual federal stats on what this is like. And I think that ties into the clinic of, like, will it even be seen as a hate crime to try and burn down a trans clinic when there's not actually any federal protections for trans people.
Up next, Ophira Horowitz tells us about a zine about traditional territory published by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
The National Campus and Community Radio Association has produced a zine about traditional Indigenous territory to be distributed to radio stations all over the country. First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, as well as settlers from coast to coast to coast, came together to create a zine filled with art and writing about what traditional territory means to them. Mia Otokiak from CFBI in Nunavut wrote about what traditional territory means to her in her hometown of Cambridge Bay. She wrote, "Traditional territory to me, here in Nunavut, is respecting the land, respecting all the things that have happened in the past, and being at peace with it. Practicing the traditional ways of hunting and fishing, keeping the tradition of what our ancestors did going to this day and passing it on to the next generation so that they can pass it on too. It's being able to survive like our ancestors did for thousands upon thousands of years in the harshest of conditions, knowing how to properly survive and hunt and being proud of it. Traditional territory is a part of every single one of us Inuit, and we may not know everything about hunting, but there will be someone who easily comes and helps us to become an even better Inuk. The zine will be distributed at the National Campus and Community Radio Conference in Ottawa this week. It will also be made for free at ncra.ca. This is Ophira Horowitz reporting for Groundwire.
A coroner's inquest into the police shooting and murder of a black man in Brampton, Jermaine Carby, took place last month, answering many questions held by Carby's family and supporters. The inquest revealed the name of the officer who shot Carby, something that was kept hidden before. Constable Ryan Reed shot Carby 7 times, including once in the back. Jermaine Carby was a passenger in a car that was pulled over by police on September 24, 2014, in Brampton, Ontario, a suburb outside of Toronto. The inquest also revealed that the eventual shooting of Carby began with the police carding Jermaine Carby. Carding is a racist practice deployed by police to discriminately stop mostly black and indigenous men without reason. Though the inquest also determined that the police shooting of Jermaine Carby was a homicide, the Peel Police's Special Investigation Unit ruled in 2015 that they would not lay charges against the officer responsible for Carby's murder. Even though the inquest determined this a homicide, it does not hold the same weight as it would in a criminal proceeding. The jurors in an inquest can issue the ruling when they determine someone is responsible for a death, but they are not allowed to say who bears that responsibility. Finally, the jury made 14 recommendations, the majority of them calling on police to develop effective methods of de-escalation and to choose the lowest level of forces possible in a given situation. They also recommended that police explore ways to overcome unconscious bias during traffic stops. Though these recommendations seem encouraging, recommendations made by an inquest jury are not at all binding. According to an article published by TVO in 2012 and 2013, less than 15% of recommendations made by coroner's inquest were actually implemented. It is likely that a verdict of homicide will be determined in the inquest into the police murder of another black man in Toronto, Andrew Locou. Though coroner's inquests use the same trial-like format as a criminal proceeding, a determination of homicide in an inquest holds no accountability or responsibility, nor even intent.
On May 24th, Vice Canada released This is Dixon, a documentary that explores the post-Rob Ford anti-Somali sentiments in Dixon and throughout Canada. Dixon is a neighborhood in northwest Toronto that is home to a large Somali community, one of the biggest diasporas in Canada. Reactions to the Vice documentary by progressive Somalis was enraged, as the documentary reproduces the very same vile and violent myths about Somali Canadians that the Toronto Police uses to legitimize its surveillance and violence within the community, such as the police raids in June 2013. Over the past month, in response to the documentary, Somali community members have led a campaign on social media under the hashtag That's Not Dixon to call upon Vice to remove the anti-black documentary from circulation and to adopt anti-racist accountability within their productions, focusing specifically on anti-blackness. Udbi is a Somali community organizer.
The documentary produces what is 2 decades of the City of Toronto and national Canadian institutions, often led by media reports vilifying the Somali community, and comes in the aftermath of similar mistreatments of the Jamaican community. The narrative Vice uses is not new. It reproduces the same historical abuses on the Somali community we have experienced by Canadian institutions, media, and the police. The documentary must be placed in a broader context of anti-black racism by the Canadian media.
Additionally, since the documentary itself was not even produced by Somalis, but rather outsiders from the United States, the community has been calling on Vice, and indeed other media outlets, to commission work from members of the Somali community to tell their own stories. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Omesama Rahimtullah on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit in Toronto.
Yeah.
Home to Me by Luigi Nan, Grassy Narrows Youth. Now it's time for our feature stories.
On June 2nd, community members from Grassy Narrows First Nation held their annual River Run in Toronto. 26 youth traveled 2 days by bus from their community to attend. Over 1,000 supporters came out to demand the provincial government take action to clean mercury from the river.
Justice for Grassy! Justice for Grassy!
It's an honor to be able to introduce Simon Bovister, Senior of Grassy Narrows.
The government of Ontario has taken the approach that nature will take its course and that the river will cleanse itself. That's what they say. And they've been saying that for years and years, and there's been no action, no action at all. I don't know how many years we had the river run, and I don't know how many Ontario regional chiefs have spoken on our behalf, demanding that the river be cleaned up, and so far there's been no action at all. Scientists have published a report saying that the mercury can be cleaned from the river system, and now Premier Nguyen, as she doesn't have, she can't explain it away now. Now we want action.
Yeah!
No more fancy words, no more studies. We know the mercury is there. We've lived it. We've lost our economy as a result. We've lost our health as a result. Now today we want action. We just want the Premier to say, I want to clean this river. Our government is going to do it.
The fight is to protect our water and the future generations of children. I'm glad to see all these little children here. And it's for them too. We fight to protect that water. And in my hand, I have water
And that's what we're fighting for, is to have clean water in our community. And the next step we want to go is Justin Trudeau. We've been dealing with the provincial government all this time, and all the time it's always just damage control for them. To say that the Canadian society, yeah, we are meeting with these Indians, we are dealing with these Indians, but in reality, the poison is still in the river. 10 tons of mercury was put in our river system, and it's still in there. So that's almost 60 years. And with you all standing behind us and pressuring the government for us, you become our amplifier for our people, because there are only 800 in the community that live there. And you amplify our voice when you go home.
So I'm coming in England to go. If they ask you anything, my mind about them. I'm coming out in England. My name is Francis Kavanagh. I'm the Grand Chief. I'm Grand Council of Treaty Number 3. Even the river has been found to be still very highly toxic. You know, even though there are examples around the world where situations like that have been remedied through clay capping of those areas that are contaminated. You know, where once lakes and waterways, where they were so contaminated, there was no life, no living organisms in those areas. But if it, because of scientists and their strategies to rehabilitate those waterways, it's been proven successful. So I don't see why Premier Wynne does not support the idea that there is a way to bring about a resolution to the issues that Grassy Narrows face on a daily basis.
Shame on
so
her.
In that regard, you know, whatever I will try from my office, you know, whatever efforts I can bring forward to make the government accountable for what's happened to the community of Grassy Narrows.
We're happy to be here to support our community in the process of getting clean water. We want the best for our many future generations. We want to be able to fish in the water without getting poisoned with mercury. We want to be heard, and I hope Premier Wynne will get it through her head that it is possible to have our water clean.
Thank you to Mandy Hiscox from CFRU in Guelph for the audio used in that report.
This past Saturday, May 21st, supporters gathered outside the Winnipeg Remand Center to remember and honor the lives of Errol Green and Holly Hall, as well as others who've died in the custody of jails in this country. Both Green and Hall died preventable deaths due to a lack of medical care while being detained at the Remand Center. Errol Green died on May 1st after suffering 2 epileptic seizures after being denied his medication for the 3 days since he was arrested and incarcerated. He was 26, a father of 3 with another on the way, and is loved and missed by many. He should still be here. Holly Hall died on March 17th from what authorities are calling influenza or a flu-like illness. There are few details as to how her illness was allowed to get so bad as to kill her. She was 38, a loving mother, and is loved and missed by many. She should still be here. One of the co-organizers of the event, Cecil James, spoke out.
And this is this is a lot more widespread than we'd like to think. This happens far too often. My sister died of a heart attack in the Regional Psychiatric Center in Saskatoon in January 2013. And we didn't have the means to go out and travel to Saskatoon and do rallies like this. So when I became aware of Holly and I became aware of Errol, I wanted to do something. I wanted to take a lead and try and do something because
On June 4th, 2 weeks after the demonstration, I had the chance to speak with Errol Green's wife, Rochelle Pranteau, about her husband and the circumstances surrounding his death.
The way how I wanted Errol to be remembered is he was a great, loving man. He was the family person. Family meant everything to him. He was funny, caring, generous. He was really nice when you actually got to know him. Wasn't really popular, but he still had friends, because his main focus was his family.
So what was the response that you wish the Remand Center or the province or the MGEU had offered after the death of your husband?
Well, there's nothing that they could really do. They should have just gave him his meds. And that's, like, the main thing right there. So there's not much that I can really say that I wish.
And their response so far has been just pure silence? They have not shared anything with you?
No, they haven't told me nothing.
And what's been the reaction of other people who were inside the Remand Center at the time of Errol's passing, like other inmates?
They said it was a wrongful death. They were shocked the way how they treated him and how they're, like, trying to cover it up.
And what are you hoping for the future in Errol's case, or more generally for people who are incarcerated and access to medication and access to proper treatment?
Things need to change, because it's important. It doesn't matter, like, what kind of meds, like, if they need the medical, they need it. Shouldn't neglect them, especially when it comes with life and death. And it could have been prevented if they did the right thing by calling 911 right away. Well, justice needs to be served, and what they're doing is covering it up and not telling me my answers is just wrong.
The Manitoba General Employees Union, or MGEU, put out a statement on May 12th asking for, quote, everyone to withhold judgment on what happened until all the facts are known, unquote. That would be a fair statement if prisons were not amongst the most secretive institutions known for rampant covering up of their own abuses. When asked to explain this demand for withholding judgment, MGEU staff claimed to be privy to information which sheds a different light on Errol's death. However, they've not shared this information with those who need it most, namely his wife and family. The testimonies of many inmates corroborate the story told so far of extreme negligence and complicity in Errol's death. The MGEU needs to either share this information with Errol's family or stop defending prison guards responsible for his death. There's lots more to do to bring some form of justice and peace for Errol Green's family, Holly Hall's family, those still behind bars, and their loved ones on the outside. This is Stéphane Doucette from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 Territory, traditional territory of the Nahiwak and Nakota, and homeland of the Métis Nation.
For this edition's Community Radio Report, Groundwire contributor Gretchen King covers the Discoverability Summit.
Several hundred participants converged in Toronto this past May at the Discoverability Summit, hosted by the National Film Board and the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission. The two-day summit concluded a series of events thinking about how audiences discover content. Many conversations focused on so-called millennials and how innovation can boost profits. But going beyond this monetization of audiences were a number of presentations that put equity on the agenda. Groundwire spoke with Commissioner Labardini of Mexico, who presented on the regulatory panel at the Discoverability Summit. The commissioner spoke about inclusive policymaking in Mexico's new regulatory mandates.
One of them, for instance, in FM radio, is to reserve up to 10% of the upper FM band exclusively to indigenous radio. They used to have so many requirements. And when you look at, for instance, in Oaxaca, well, the rich Zapotec and Mixtec communities, they are, by our constitution, entitled to their political organization of traditional indigenous people. And so we cannot require them to incorporate an NGO like in the Western world. So we are respecting their human rights.
Her co-panelist, Dr. Turner Lee, a sociologist from a U.S.-based multicultural advocacy organization, discussed the importance of equity in media literacy in conversations about discoverability.
What was fascinating about your presentation today is that you actually put equity at the front and center of your presentation, and it wasn't on the title of any of the talks or mentioned anywhere in the agenda of the Discoverability Summit. So maybe you can speak from a perspective of why you wanted to focus on equity within this conversation on discoverability.
Yeah, it's hard not to exclude the concept of equity from these conversations. I mean, when you think of equity, you have to think of it as like a three-tiered issue. One, you have the equity of access, like the ability of people in this country, in Canada, in the globe, to be able to access content. You know, the ability to be online, engaged in a medium that is relevant and pertinent today. Can they get that same access? Is that access affordable? Is it where they live? I mean, you know, if most of our news is being played over the internet, but half of the world doesn't have access, then you're really creating a disadvantage there. It's equity in terms of stakes and opportunity, right? The extent to which people have the ability to tell their own, to do their own storytelling, right? And I think that people in this country, in Canada, you know, they should not necessarily just be consumers of content. They should be producers of content. They should be creators of it. And then I think three, so you have the equity of access, the equity in opportunity. I think there has to be equity at the core of the conversation, right? And you have to get equity in a place where government officials are talking about it, community stakeholders are talking about it. So that's why, you know, I always kind of start there, hoping that I have an audience that is open to the conversation. If you're not, it doesn't matter. I'm going to talk about it anyway.
Well, judging by the applause in the room, you were well received. Can you just talk a little bit about what you perceive the role of media literacy is in promoting more equitable content?
I mean, one of the things in listening to this conference, which has been so eye-opening, in the last panel we just left, even with millennials, you cannot believe everything that you read. Your understanding of media sources and media content is equivocal to your understanding of your civil rights and civil liberties.
One voice missing among Discoverability Summit participants was that of the so-called millennials. Those who did attend the summit as presenters, like CBC producer Amanda Paris, noted this absence and the value of younger voices participating in conversations about discoverability as policymaking stakeholders.
What was the millennial participation like here at the Discoverability Summit?
Well, it was actually organized as a separate sort of participation. So on May 2nd, they held a specific to youth summit at the CBC that brought together over 100 young people from across Toronto.
Do you think there is a role for young people such as yourself as a young media maker to be involved in policymaking about your future as a media consumer?
Well, I think the way that it was structured in terms of the separate event made sense because the young people that they engaged were high school students, and I don't know that high school students would have felt as engaged. But for older millennials who are still relevant, who might be developing careers or attempting to develop careers in this particular space and are also utilizing a lot of these platforms in very creative and interesting ways and are already developing content, not just consuming it, I think that there would be a really interesting role that they could play in a space such as this, and in shaping policy and in providing feedback and also learning about all the new things that I learned about today, like virtual reality.
From the Discoverability Summit in Toronto, this is Gretchen King from CKUT Radio in Montreal, reporting for Groundwire.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CILU in Thunder Bay on Anishinaabe territory, I'm J.L. Chung.
And I'm Carly Forbes. Headlines this week were by Omay Sama Rahimtula, Ophira Horowitz, and Lindsay Nixon.
Thank you to Michael Welch, Stéphane Doucet, Gretchen King, Catherine Fisher, and Mandy Hiscox.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, rabble.ca, or download it at groundwirenews.ca.